Given Paul's knowledge of the universal scope of the gospel, he begins to unfold the basis of his unqualified confidence. Why is he absolutely confident in this message, such that he could deliver the same message to anybody in the world, anytime, anywhere, whatever? And he's going to tell us he's not ashamed of the gospel for three reasons. We have to totally ignore that division in the NIV there, where if there was going to be any division, it should come after verse 15, but such divisions are not always very helpful anyway. But after he's in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of stating his three reasons, and then the NIV puts that break in, which is awful, because then, amazingly, loads of commentaries think that that's almost real, and they, a real division in Paul, and they end up starting a new section themselves then, which is amazing, really. So Paul is in the middle of, in verse 17, laying out his three reasons why he's not ashamed. He says, I am not ashamed of the gospel because, and then here he's going to list three reasons. Firstly, he's not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, whether Jew or Gentile. It is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, Jew or Gentile. The Jews received the gospel first, and now it's going out to the whole Gentile world. Paul will develop this argument in much more detail later in chapters 9 to 11, how that is. Secondly, he's not ashamed of the gospel because, verse 17, see, so you can see the fours, like because, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God, then verse 17, because in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. This is the point he'll open up in chapter 3 for us. A righteousness from God is revealed. So, and he just concludes verse 17 with the quotation from Habakkuk 2 verse 4, a verse that will prove quite critical to his argument from chapter 2. The righteous will live by faith. But it's the third argument, the third reason he's not ashamed of the gospel, that he's going to really unfold for us in the rest of Romans chapter 1. He is not ashamed of the gospel. Verse 18 ought to begin with the word for also, which has been omitted from the English in the NIV, which is a shame. Because, so I'm not ashamed of the gospel because of the power of God, because in the gospel the righteousness of God is revealed, and because the wrath of God is being revealed. The wrath of God is being revealed. This is what he expounds straight away. One of the commentators called Cranfield is right to give this section the title Humanity Under the Judgment of the Gospel. Under the judgment of the gospel. Since the beginning of the world, God had said he was angry about sin. I mean, he said that right at the very beginning. If you do this, you've had it. But they didn't. And all the prophets and Moses, God is really angry, and you know, serious trouble is going to ensue because of sin. Really? Is that true? Where was this threatened judgment day? It's never happened. This wrath of God, where is it? All right, there's a few like little incidents, but there's nothing like the scale of what was threatened. Where is this wrath? Humanity continued to live on in their rebellion. The wrath against sin that the Lord spoke of, has he forgotten it? God was, in fact, worse than that. He's not just not fully revealing his wrath, but actually he's being gracious and forgiving to people. On what basis? The gospel reveals just how angry the living God is with respect to sin. See, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because the wrath of God is being revealed in the gospel. The wrath of God is being revealed in the gospel. How's that? Well, at the cross, we finally see the uncompromising hostility of God towards sin. That's when he backs up all his threats. And he says, see, now you can see how angry I am about sin when you look at the gospel, the cross. Sin is so serious that it requires the death of the Son of God, the one whom he loves so much, the one that he, in whom he is glorified, the only one in whom he is glorified. It requires the death of that one for sin to be dealt with. In chapter 3, verse 25 to 26, Paul will highlight this point. Only by the cross do we see that God is justified in justifying sinners. Without the cross, he seems to have been illegally forgiving people. He seems to have been not really angry with sin, and that he's really just compromising on sin finally. But when we look at the cross, we see, no, he isn't compromising. In fact, he is more angry and serious about sin than we ever dreamed he was. So by the gospel, both God's love and his anger are revealed, his grace and his wrath. As Cranfield puts it, the two revelations referred to in these verses are really two aspects of the same thing. The preaching of Christ crucified, risen, ascended, and coming again is at the same time both the offer to men of a status of righteousness before God and the revelation of God's wrath against their sin. In the gospel, the divine mercy and the divine judgment are inseparable from each other. The forgiveness offered to us is forgiveness without condoning. Now, the fact that the wrath of God, the anger of God, the fury of the Lord has been kept under control for so long, for thousands of years since the beginning of the world, until the proper time, shows that it's not a blind, irrational fury. Some people say that, this idea of an anger is ridiculous. The idea that he flies into a rage at any moment and, you know, uncontrollably and irrationally. No, of course that's not true. For thousands of years, he has in fact contained and controlled this wrath until the proper time. Nevertheless, since the beginning of the world, God has been angry with the godlessness and wickedness of humanity. And that tells us the gospel is not about abstract justice, you know, the idea of justice in a neutral sense, like balancing the books and making sure that all laws have been carried out or anything like that. It's nothing abstract or dispassionate at all. It's about the gospel is about the hatred of God against evil, about it's good versus evil and God's hatred against evil. It's about his anger against our own evil. That's what the gospel is, the basis of the whole issue. And in the gospel, the real basis of humanity's alienation from God is exposed. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. See, against the godlessness and wickedness of men. So, God, there isn't a problem between God and humanity because we are, say, creatures. So, you know, he is the creator, we are the creatures. There's the big difference. No, that's not the difference. And it's not because we are finite. You know, we are small, he is large. That's the problem. That's not a problem. Or that we are physical, he is spiritual. That's not a problem. Or we are weak, he is strong. That's not the problem. We are condemned because we have rebelled against God. Specifically, we've rejected Jesus the Lord. We have insulted and personally offended the great and eternal Trinitarian God. We are godless. How can we be godless given God, who he is, that he's created all things? We are products of him and yet we are godless. How can that be? It is wickedness, as Paul calls it in verse 18. So that's why he's not ashamed. All this is made clear in the gospel. He has confidence. The only way in which the real problem with humanity is made clear, and the severity of that with respect to God. But look at the enormous claim in verse 19. Why this wicked? Because we immediately might think, well, we're not, humanity ain't that wicked, really. Maybe ignorant, maybe mistaken, maybe misguided, but not really wicked, not deliberately attacking God. Surely we're all thinking that if we read the argument. So Paul immediately backs it up, verse 19. Since they suppress the truth by their wickedness, that is, they know the truth but deliberately reject it. Verse 19, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. He makes the remarkable claim that what can be known about, everything that can be known about God is obvious to everybody. It's obvious to everybody. What does he mean? Well, it's led some commentators to imagine some strange things from this verse. Some have said that, well, Paul, of course, doesn't really mean what may be known about God is known to everybody. He's saying a few incidental things about God is known to everybody. That's what he's saying. I mean, you'd be surprised. In fact, I'd probably say most commentators would take that to mean a few incidental things about God may be known to people, but not what may be known about God is plain to everybody. So they would say, some commentators, that there is a kind of a general idea, the concept of God, for instance. So even a pagan, maybe they're a polytheist or a Unitarian or a pantheist or a monotheist, whatever. And that is a sort of, they have received this general idea of God from the creation. See what I mean? I've heard that sort of thing. You probably heard that too. So they're saying, oh yeah, then that's a kind of a partial response to what may be known of God. But that's rubbish, isn't it? That's not what Paul says. He says, no, what may be known about God is obvious to everybody. God is known to everybody. And you remember, we're going to look at that more in Romans chapter 10, but let's just remind ourselves of it. Romans chapter 10, verse 18, when Paul says, you know, he asks the question, is it possible that people haven't heard of Jesus? He says, no, of course everybody's heard of Jesus. He just says, of course they have. Psalm 19, verse 4, of course they've heard the word of Jesus. The whole creation proclaims Jesus. We'll look at that in more detail when we have a look at Romans chapter 10. Great chorus, isn't it? Jesus is Lord. Creation's voice proclaims it. Of course it does. It doesn't proclaim that anyone else is Lord. Certainly not some vague God. What would be the point in doing it? If the creation is proclaiming a God other than Jesus Christ, then the creation's heretical and it must be denounced as a liar. No, of course the creation proclaims the truth about God. What may be known about God is known because God has made it known. The great bishop, of course, the early generations of Christians were very clear on this. The great bishop Athanasius from 298 to 373 explains this, that the creation everywhere reveals Christ. Here's one quotation from him. He said it was open to humanity, it was available to humanity, by looking into the height of heaven and perceiving the harmony of creation, to know its ruler, the Word of the Father, who, by his own providence over all things, makes known the Father to all, and to this end moves all things, that through him all may know God. See that? And Athanasius says, if you really look at the creation properly, you will learn that Christ is the mediator of the Father, making him known. And I said, I don't think that when I look at creation. That is because of the problem in verse 18. That's the problem of humanity, isn't it? The creation, then, is not a vague word about God. Rather, it proclaims the clear truth of God, the clear word of the Father. And the rest of chapter 1 now is going to explain to us why sinful humanity does not, is blind to or deaf to the evangelistic sermon of creation. So, God has set the truth of himself plainly before us. Even Jesus Christ is set before us, verse 19. And he's done this since the creation of the world, verse 20. Look at that. Since the creation of the world, even God's invisible qualities, even God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen. Even the invisible things of God have been clearly seen. Seen, being understood from what has been made, so that humanity has no excuse. How can the invisible things of God be clearly seen? Well, surely, by definition, if they're invisible, you can't see them. Oh, but no, actually, the invisible God has a visible form, doesn't he? Colossians 1:15-17. Jesus Christ is the visible form of the invisible God, the one through whom the whole creation exists. Colossians 1:15-17 makes a great meditation to study as we look at this section of Romans chapter 1. Through Jesus, the power and nature of God is clearly revealed. God cannot be known other than in and through Jesus Christ. We know that. He is the Word of the Father. And we should not think, when he says, it's a maximal thing, isn't it? He's saying God's invisible qualities, like just the minimum of God. No, it's the maximum, isn't it? Even the invisible qualities. So, you know, that means even the hardest things to know about God are clearly known, like that. But then he says, his eternal power and divine nature, what it is that makes God, God. Do you know what I mean? The divine nature is not like, oh, just some general thing. It's what makes God, God. So if someone says to you, what does make God, God? What's the reply? How do we answer? The divine nature is, of course, the relationship between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The divine nature is that God is Trinitarian. This is, of course, most clearly revealed in humanity, created as male and female in the image of God. Genesis 1 verse 27. There is the place where the divine nature becomes visible in a very real sense. Paul explains that in more detail, doesn't he, in 1 Corinthians 11 verses 1 to 16, when he shows that the relationship between male and female is the image of the relationship between the Father and the Son. This is going to have great significance for his arguments moves on in chapter 1. So, look at how verse 20 concludes. If this is the case, that even the invisible things of God are clearly seen, and the divine nature, and what may be known about God is known to everybody because God's made it so. If all that is the case, obviously, humanity has no excuse. No one can say, well, sorry, I just didn't know about this. Of course I would have believed in Jesus, but I just didn't know about it. Of course no one can make that excuse because, specified, everybody does know. Now, again, a little problem. So men are without excuse. Let's just, again, think about that possibility that some people have offered. When they say that the revelation in creation is not a revelation of Jesus, but just a general idea of God. Okay, so let's just think about it. So let's examine that argument. So first, the revelation in creation is not about Jesus, it's just a general idea of God. But secondly, can you be saved? Are you going on judgment? Can you be saved by that? By the concept of God without Jesus? Or on judgment day, is he going to say, well, do you have a concept of God? Yeah? Oh, that's right then. Is that going to happen? It's not going to happen. That is not going to render people say, oh, it's all right. No, you're all right. You're in. You only needed a concept of God. I mean, even then the Baal worshippers would be in. The Satanists would be in if they thought Satan was God. See, no. That a knowledge of God that isn't about Jesus is not of any use to anybody. It's not going to render anybody inexcusable. You know, no, it is precisely because the word of the Father, Jesus Christ, the one in whom we must trust, it is him, because it is him that is shouted in our ears by every detail of reality, all day, every day. It's because of that that humanity is so justly condemned. But how is it that we have become so deaf to such a loud shout? If it really is such a loud shout in every detail, how are we so deaf to it? Surely somebody must at least hear it a little bit. Verse 21. Although they, humanity, knew God once, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. See, Paul's going to explain now how it is that people's minds could be so unenlightened or so closed off to truth. So in verse 21, we're reminded of the original rebellion of humanity. The past tense is very important here. He's not saying, although everybody knows God, so has a true knowledge of God in that way, they neither glorified him. They knew God. It's not that the fall is reenacted in everybody's life, everybody individually falls. No, once in the Garden of Eden, humanity knew God properly, without darkness and blindness and everything. The high point in the history of the human race so far was at the beginning. You know, history is not from little things to great things. It was from great things to now just us downhill. However, even though we knew the Father through the Son at our origin, yet in Adam, we did not give him the glory or gratitude that we should have done. Rather, in failing to trust in Christ's word of warning in the garden, as a race, we became intellectually vain and blind in our foolish hearts. Interesting, isn't it? Intellectually futile. Verse 21. So it's not like the intellect is protected from sin. You know, I'll just think really clearly about this. I'll apply my logical skills and reason it out. Of course not. That is like the very first thing he specifies as the effect of sin. Thinking became futile, intellectually futile. And foolish hearts were darkened. Verse 22, although humanity thought it was wise, very clever, to steal the knowledge of good and evil, yet the only result was that we became fools. Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden as fools, not as people who had the great knowledge of God. And the consequences of our rebellion have rolled on down through history, haven't they? Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged what for what? Exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. So, instead of what is the glory of the immortal God? Jesus Christ. So there is the exchange of Jesus Christ, who is the real one that the creation testifies to, the real one in whom the knowledge is to be found and wisdom. Instead of seeing Jesus in the creation, we have recognized a false god or gods in the creation. Gods derived from our own dark and foolish hearts. Gods made in the image of sinful humanity. And animals. Now, of course, the word animals there in verse 23. It's worth having an authorized version, or I'll have here the New King James version. What's useful is it's a little bit more literal, straight to the Greek. And the phrase is birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Now, is he specifically specifying, you know, to make like four-footed animals, when of course we know God is a two-footed thing, you know, because he looks like us. I don't know. Let's just not get distracted by that, possibly, but I think there's something in there. So that's the choice. It was Jesus being exchanged for human-invented gods. But such willful rejection of Christ has consequences, and that's what he moves on to now. So because humanity have done this, therefore, verse 24, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. Now, why does he focus on this? Well, we cannot become ignorant with impunity. God gave us the fruit of our rebellion in giving us up to our intellectual vanity and darkened hearts. He said, if that's what you want, you have that. And the consequences of that are apparent, verse 24. Now, why does Paul immediately go to this issue of the degrading of the human body? Because it is precisely the human body, the human form, that is the greatest and clearest revelation of the divine nature. As we saw in Genesis 1:27, male and female. The humanity is the only thing that is in the image of God in the whole creation. So he immediately focuses our attention at the worst part of the rebellion. The human form was made to reveal Christ, yet in our unbelief, the use of the human body has become the center of our rebellion rather than the pinnacle of our glory. As Isaiah says, isn't it? You know, the human form is the glory of humanity. So the human body is now dishonored through lust. Thus the creation became to us a perverted object of worship rather than a sermon about Christ. The truth about God, proclaimed in every detail of his creation, was turned into a lie, a statement of humanity's rebellion against Christ. So because the image of God was focused in humanity, so it is in humanity that the consequences of our sin is focused. Verses 26 to 27. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts, even though women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones, in the same way the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. Well, it's fairly clear, isn't it? If a person says, well, what's the biblical view of homosexuality? I think that's relatively clear. Verses 26 to 27. And again, he's focusing on it, not just because he's like a homophobe and he can't get off the subject or something. It's part of the argument, isn't it? You see it? Because it's in humanity where the invisible qualities of God are made so visible, so concrete, so clear. So he focuses on it, that the irony of it, that the sinfulness like goes out of its way to obscure the revelation of God in humanity. Even more so, it's as if to say, there the God is most clearly revealed. So that is where we will focus our darkness and rebellion. Our existence as male and female in sin no longer explains the being of God. You know, people say, whether you're man or woman, it's irrelevant. The question is you're a person. And one person loves another person. It doesn't matter whether you're a man or woman. Have you ever heard that kind of thing? That's the kind of philosophy of sexuality that today. Of course, that's ridiculous. It's tremendously significant, male and female. So in alienation from the prototype, the image becomes confusion. Homosexuality is not just a moral failure. It's a rejection of the Trinitarian nature of God. It's an attack on the doctrine of God. Paul's use of the word nature here, when he says natural relations and all that sort of thing, he's calling us back to the way that humanity was originally created to be male and female. Because remember, his whole thought here is in the book of Genesis, creation and fall and things. He's not saying, when he uses the word natural, he's not saying what feels natural. That's a totally different ball game, because people say, well, I don't find that very natural to be heterosexual. He's not interested in what people feel to be natural. He's talking about what was our creation. So the confusion of our sexuality is a consequence of our rebellion. But even these consequences have consequences. Can you see from verse 28? You say, it's just spiraling down. The due penalty for this perversion is a deeper alienation from God, a more profound deafness to the sermon of creation. Furthermore, since they didn't think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over, again, to an even more depraved mind. intellectual again. Notice how he begins by dethroning the human intellect to do what ought not to be done. So verses 28 to 31. The corruption which our rebellion has brought upon us cannot be confined to any one area of life. It has spread and infected every aspect of our being. Once our minds have become closed to the true nature of reality, once our minds have become depraved, then unavoidable wickedness flows out. The human race is filled with, verse 29, every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. What a statement. Every kind of wickedness and depravity, verse 29. No matter what evil, and that's humanity, no matter what evil we see in others, we can rest assured that it is the common evil of humanity. Whatever we see in others, it is in us. The murderer, the liar, the thief, the rapist, the war criminal, the child molester, they are not a different species. They are us. They're not a different species. They are human beings. They are us. Sinful humans like the rest of us, in whom certain of the fruits of sin have become more pronounced. The same root is in us all. It can all, the same plant grows in us all that will bear the same fruit. Verse 30 accuses the whole race of being God haters. Isn't that extraordinary? God haters. That's what humanity is. What a condemnation. What are the devout Muslim and the sincere Hindu? The gentle Buddhist? Whatever. Well, God haters. They are insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. Well, the very fact that they have created idolatrous, intellectual, and material idols shows that they hate the word of the Father and prefer their own gods. Insolent, arrogant, and boastful. All necessary consequences of rejecting the one word of God. If God says, this is how I am, this is how I am, yeah? If the person says, well, I don't think so. I don't like to think of God like that. Oh man, that's so insolent and arrogant and boastful. Isn't it intolerable for when God has spoken to say, no, I don't think so. I'll maybe take that on board though. It's outrageous. That's why verse 30 reaches its climax in disobedience to parents. Why? Because that's a symptom of our disobedience to God. Our parents model God to us. And the fact that we disobey our parents so instinctively, you don't need to teach a kid to do that. They do that. Shows our instinctive disobedience to the Lord. The NIV has that quite powerful medley there in verse 31 as a kind of a deadly rhythm to it, doesn't it? Senseless, faithless, heartless. Heartless. Ruthless. That is the human heart. Without understanding, without honour, without natural affections, and without mercy. The diagnosis couldn't be more terrible. There are no fig leaves left after this stripping of humanity's self-confidence, self-righteousness. Paul concludes the revelation of humanity's corruption with that shocking final thing, verse 32. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also, and this is his ultimate climax of it, also approve of those who practice them. Those who approve of evil actions, he says, are even worse than those who do them. That's the kind of thing, isn't it? The cheering crowd is even more horrible than the crime, isn't it? If a crime being committed is one thing, if the crowd is cheering, how much worse? Much worse. The applause is even worse than the offence. When society condones the extermination of different people groups or fetuses or the disabled, things are much, much worse than any individual act. When we giggle about disobedient children or something, we're worse than the child because we're providing the context in which such evil can be perpetrated. When Paul says that humanity knows that such things deserve death, and there in verse 32, he is, of course, not referring to capital punishment. No country executes people for arrogance or gossip, which is listed, remember, in verse 29 and 30. At least I'm not aware that any country does that for arrogance or gossip. Rather, of course, he is speaking of God's original righteous decree, Genesis 2, 16 and 17, that godlessness brings death, both spiritually and physically. So Paul leaves us gasping, doesn't he? Gasping. Are there no mitigating circumstances? There are no mitigating circumstances? Surely this isn't true of the moral Jew who has the Ten Commandments and is living morally in faithfulness to the Ten Commandments. Surely that's not true of them. That's where chapter 2 begins.